Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week and supporting public media. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. My co-host, Melissa Ross, is off this week. It took just 2 weeks between a presidential tweet and decision, and now Florida Republicans have 75 days to get ready to host the 2020 Republican National Convention. In late August, President Trump will come to Jacksonville, not Charlotte, North Carolina, to accept the GOP presidential nomination. The president wanted North Carolina to guarantee Republicans would be able to have a full convention without social distancing rules meant to fight the spread of COVID-19. Now, the official business of the Republicans will remain in Charlotte, but the celebrations and the thousands of attendees will gather here in the Sunshine State in Jacksonville. The official announcement from the Republican National Committee made no mention of public health practices to fight the spread of the coronavirus that may be in place when it comes to Jacksonville in late August. Moving the public part of the convention to Florida will bring the president to a state that he has to win in November to stay in the White House, and to a state that has been hit hard by the economic consequences of fighting COVID-19, and to a state that on Thursday and then again on this Friday experienced its highest new confirmed coronavirus cases in a single day. So this is where we'll begin this hour on the statewide roundup. What do you think of the RNC coming to Jacksonville? Will you attend any of the festivities? What issue will decide your vote this fall? Phone lines are open now, 305-995-1800. All across the state of Florida, 305-995-1800. If you cannot make it to a phone, send us a tweet. Florida Roundup is our Twitter handle. Let's begin with Dean Black, the chairman of the Republican Party of Duval County. Dean, welcome to the Florida Roundup, and congratulations on getting the celebrations for the RNC to come to Jacksonville.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me on. We're ecstatic in Duval County, and we are thrilled for all of North Florida and for our entire state.
Let's talk first about kind of any assurances that the RNC or the president may have received from Jacksonville. As we know, at the heart of the friction with Charlotte and North Carolina were the guidelines of facial coverings and social distancing. The Jacksonville mayor, Lenny Curry, who has been very vocal in attracting the RNC to town, has encouraged people to wear masks in public in his community. The governor, Ron DeSantis, has extended social distancing guidelines until June 30th. Are there any assurances that those kind of guidances will be dropped by the time the president comes to Jacksonville in late August?
Well, the assurance that we have is that we're going to do everything possible to make the event possible, but consistent with responsible governance and consistent with reasonable and prudent health precautions. And I think the guidance they were getting from North Carolina, it seems that they were looking for a way not to let it happen rather than the opposite.
So has there been any explicit or implicit pledges on the part of public health officials or organizers or elected officials about not following social distance guidelines that are in place currently, right now as we speak here in June?
Well, look, there are going to be guidelines in place, and already some of those guidelines are being talked about, and certainly we will announce that in light of more fully developed information as we get closer to that time. Already, RNC Chairwoman McDaniel has discussed taking temperatures, making sure everything is sanitized, and look, here in Jacksonville, we have among the lowest COVID transmission rates on the face of the earth. We have very good Republican governance here, and we expect that we will continue to employ very responsible government. We will be careful, they will pay attention, they will be prudent, we will have sensible precautions. But this idea that during the pandemic, which is a tragedy and we all hate it, it's worldwide, but the idea that we can all crawl under a rock and allow our economy to stop is not credible. We can't do that. Eventually, the resulting famine would kill more people than the pandemic ever would. And likewise, history cannot stop either. And history is coming to be made in Jacksonville, and it's going to be made in a responsible, prudent and celebratory manner.
Dean, is it your understanding that the Republican National Committee and the Republican National Convention would abide by all public health measures that are recommended or suggested that are in place in Duval County in late August?
It's my understanding that we will employ responsible, prudent precautions in light of fully developed information as we get closer to that time. And Jacksonville is an exceptional city.
The Centers for Disease Control, for instance, is recommending social distancing 6 feet apart. If that remains in place, will the convention go on with that social distancing guideline enforced?
We will make those decisions based on the guidance of leaders as that guidance exists at that time.
And if that guidance is in force at that time, would the convention abide by it?
I do not speak for the Committee on Arrangements. I am the Republican Party of Duval County Chair. But what I can tell you is we have responsible leaders behaving responsibly, and I expect what is done will be sensible and responsible concerning the circumstances as they exist near that time.
I appreciate that, Dean. Dean Black is with us, the chairman of the Republican Party of Duval County. Jacksonville learned officially late last night on Thursday night that the Republican National Committee celebrations for the presidential nominating convention will come to Jacksonville in late August. Dean, the president will deliver his acceptance speech on the 60th anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday. This is a day when a white mob with axe handles attacked a mostly black civil rights group of protesters for sitting at a whites-only lunch counter or lunch counters throughout Jacksonville. Happened 60 years ago in 1960. What is the significance of that timing?
Difficult days in our nation's history have occurred on practically every day across America. And I think that the significance for us can be one of healing. This idea that the Republican National Convention coming to Jacksonville somehow must necessarily be divisive, I think that's erroneous. I've already said this is only divisive if we choose to let it be so. Jacksonville is going to be a good host to our guests from all across the nation and the world. And we mean to get back to the idea that we are one family. We are one people. It wasn't all that long ago that this great spectacle of our great democracy occurred every 4 years, and it wasn't divisive. And it's time that we got back to that. And we need to let this be a thing that unifies all of us, Republican, Democrat, and Independent alike. Let us celebrate the great light that is our Constitution, that is our type of governance. And let us demonstrate once again to the nation from Jacksonville and to the world why America is the world's great hope. We can do this. We used to do it not that long ago. And we're going to let this be something that unifies us. If you want to come here and protest, by all means protest. Everyone should have their say. But let us do it in a manner that is respectful and peaceful and honors our forebears and our Constitution.
Regarding your intent on unity and the historic timing of the what will likely be the presidential acceptance speech of the GOP presidential nomination on this Axe Handle Saturday anniversary, what would your guidance be to the president about whether or not he acknowledges that historic timing in any kind of acceptance speech in downtown Jacksonville on that night?
As a county party chairman, I don't think I give guidance to the president. It's the other way around.
So you would not offer any ideas to him or his planning staff regarding that historic timing?
The president will be very much aware of our community and the many wonderful things that Jacksonville has to offer.
Speaking of which, Dean, let me ask you, it was 15 years ago when Jacksonville hosted the Super Bowl. Cruise ships were brought in to help supply hotel rooms, accommodations. Are similar kind of needs necessary for this quick of a turnaround for what's likely to be tens of thousands of visitors?
Well, that's a good question. And since then, many, many hotel rooms have been added to North Florida. Plus, you also have things like Airbnb, and we expect to have abundant accommodations. And it's not like the occupancy rates were all that high to begin with. The hotels have been suffering, the bars have been suffering, the restaurants have been suffering. So we are looking forward to playing host city to a historic event. We have a wonderful city, a great downtown, supportive business community. We're recruiting volunteers through rncvolunteer.com, and we think it's going to be just fine. There were plenty of rooms available, and the economic impact in North Florida is going to ripple throughout the state, quite frankly. And it's coming at just the time when it was most needed.
Dean, let me ask you about the politics in Duval County, of which you're very familiar as the chair of the Republican Party there. You have called that county critical to the president winning Florida. That's what you write in your online letter on the county Republican website. The president won by 1.5 percentage points in 2016. The county did go for now former Democratic Senator Bill Nelson in 2018, and Democrat Andrew Gillum beat Ron DeSantis in Duval by about 4% in 2018. So the win seems to be at the backs for Democratic voters in Duval County. What does the president, what's the message that he needs to bring that's local for Jacksonville and the surrounding communities?
Well, it's his message of restoring our economy. You know, this president came in, our economy wasn't doing well. He restored it and created...
The unemployment rate was much lower in Florida 4 years ago than it is today.
I'll answer your question. And he restored our economy and made it the most powerful it has ever been. And yes, it has been derailed by the COVID-19 pandemic. And having fixed our economy once before, it's only logical that he would be the one to turn to now fix it again. He did it before. He can do it again. That's a powerful message. As for the Republican Party of Duval County, we are aware of the political circumstances here. It's one of the reasons why I ran for and was elected chairman. And we are building our local efforts so that we can register Republican voters, turn them out to the polls, deliver Duval County, and ensure that Florida is won by President Trump and he gathers our electoral college votes on his way to victory.
Dean, I appreciate the thoughts. Good luck on hosting the convention.
Thank you so much. We're looking forward to it.
Appreciate it. Dean Black, our guest here as we begin the Florida Roundup, talking about the Republican National Convention celebrations coming to Jacksonville in late August. Dean is the chair of the Duval County Republican Party. Your phone calls, 305-995-1800. The last time the Republicans held a convention, a presidential convention in Florida, it was in Tampa. That's where Mitch is calling us from. Mitch, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure thing. Your thoughts?
How are you, Tim? Well, my thoughts are that those were some nice, windy words of delusion from your guest to kick the show off. Initially, those are my first thoughts. My second thoughts are that I believe it's a you asked the question is about how this would affect somebody's vote, and for me, it doesn't affect my vote in any way, shape, or form. The decision to move the Republican convention from Charlotte to Jacksonville, I believe, is a tragedy for the state of Florida, and I also believe that Darwin will probably do his thing. And that is unfortunate for the people that come into contact with the people that decide to go to that thing. But it'll be what it'll be. And that's kind of the way it goes, I suppose. So,
Mitch, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us there from Tampa. Larry is in Jacksonville. Larry, go ahead. You're on the radio now.
Thank you for taking my call. I do appreciate it. I have to agree with your previous caller, media caller, just Mitch now, that the opening comments from the Republican, Duval County Republican chairman were a little lofty and a little airy. I think that I live here in Jacksonville. I've been here for 15 years, and I do agree with a couple of things that he said. Yes, Jacksonville can do this. It is a great town. It would really be a great host city. They just shouldn't do it. This shows an amazing amount of irresponsibility on the Republican leadership. It seems very childish to me that the president, you know, if I can't have a big party, then I'm taking my campaign and going home. Kind of mentality is just irresponsible. There are still numbers coming in that are, you know, Florida had its highest new infection rate of COVID-19 cases this week.
Twice this week, on Thursday and today on this Friday.
Thank you, both days. And so why we're pushing to do this is definitely much more politically motivated than even to generate, you know, party spirit. This is it. Jacksonville can do this. This 75 days is not enough time to do it. And I've seen the city screw up a great many things. This could just be the next one. With that being said, Mayor Curry has done a pretty good job in office, and it kills me to say that, but it's the truth. He really has. But I think that the decision to bring the convention here was childish from the get-go, but now it just falls to irresponsibility on both local government as well as the national party.
Larry, we appreciate you sharing your thoughts, your concerns as a Jacksonville resident on the Republican National Committee moving its celebrations for its presidential nominating convention to Jacksonville in late August. Adam Goodman joins us now via FaceTime, a partner at Ballard Partners and a Republican media strategist, long known in Florida and elsewhere. Adam, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for your time today.
Great to be a part of the show. Thanks for having me.
Adam, are you with us?
Yeah, can you
hear
me? There
we go. Hey, Adam, how are you? Thanks for joining us. Let me ask about this Florida convention, or at least the celebration part of the convention, the real public-facing part of the convention, the balloon drop and the presidential acceptance speech and all that. Does that build a bigger tent for the National Republican Party that it may need here in 2020?
Well, if you're talking about Jacksonville, let's start there. I heard one of the other comments from a caller that, and I understand the point of view that I think he was coming from Tampa and said it's not going to have any impact on my vote.
Right.
I think this will have impact in Jacksonville. So,
and how so?
State. Well, let me say it this way: if this were a state that is much more homogeneous in terms of media markets, in terms of population, then if you hold it in the state, I think it could have some impact on the statewide vote. Florida is the melting pot of America when it comes to elections now. I don't think there's no argument anymore for that. Jacksonville is one part of that melting pot, a significant part. And I think in one of the most important swing vote sectors of the state, Duval in particular. So that may have some impact in terms of the final turnout, final vote there. But I agree with the caller from Tampa and others that if you live in Naples or you live in Fort Lauderdale, I think it's going to have less impact, frankly, there. The biggest thing that's going to move the needle, if at all, is going to be what people feel coming out of this convention. And conventions now, more than anything, Tom, are choreographed messages mm-hmm. that parties put on to basically drive the narrative into the fall election. So the Democrats will have the first shot at that. The Republicans will, in a way, have the second shot and the response to that. And that sets the markers for how the conversation may go as we move into the fall election.
Adam, stick with us. We're going to take a quick time out here talking politics as the celebrations for the Republican National Convention in August have been moved from Charlotte, North Carolina to Jacksonville. President Trump will give his presidential nominating acceptance speech in the Sunshine State here in August of 2020. 305-995-1800 is our phone number. What are the issues that's deciding your vote in November? 305-995-1800. You can also send us a tweet. We are on Twitter. Look for us at Florida Roundup. You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. My co-host Melissa Ross is off this week. The Republican National Convention is coming to Jacksonville, at least the most public parts of the convention. The Republican National Committee announced Thursday night it would move the public celebrations from Charlotte, North Carolina to Jacksonville, including President Trump's acceptance speech. The president wanted guarantees from North Carolina that the GOP would have a full convention without requiring facial coverings or social distancing. protocols that have been put in place to slow the spread of COVID-19. 305-995-1800 is our phone number, 305-995-1800. We'll get to your phone calls in just a moment. Adam Goodman is still with us, partner at Ballard Partners and a Republican media strategist. Adam, 4 years ago, Donald Trump did not have a political record to run on. He ran against the establishment and successfully, obviously, ran against that political establishment. Now he does have a 3.5-year record as president. How does that record shape how he's going to be running and messaging and going after those Florida votes?
That's a great question. And you're absolutely right. 4 years ago was a referendum on the status quo. And Secretary Clinton really represented that, yep, that status quo as opposed to Trump. But it's a very curious thing in 2020. And I argue that for the first time in all of our lifetimes, we have an incumbent who still feels a bit like a challenger. Even though he has 3.5 years in office, he's been taking on the system from day one, like him or not, like what he's done or not. The president of the United States has followed through on that promise. And so you're not voting for, do you like the status quo or do you want change? Because the option here for change is really no change at all, in the sense that you look at Joe Biden, who is, like Secretary Clinton was, a poster child for the system that was. And I think when you get into a two-person race, Tom, as opposed to where we are now, which is a referendum on the president, it becomes an entirely different affair. And that's why I think when the tragedy with George Floyd, in a way, was the beginning of the campaign for president in 2020.
But the 2016 campaign became a referendum on personality as well, not policy. And I suppose one could argue that's the case in modern history, with the making of the modern president beginning perhaps maybe in 1960, of course, with the Kennedy-Nixon debates on television. Is it even more so now? And as we're seeing, you know, the politicalization of COVID-19, as we're seeing the coronavirus response in North Carolina being pointed to by the president as the reason for moving the public celebration to Florida.
So your question is?
So the question is, it seems even more leveraged toward personality and not policy, not economic policy, not returning to work or, you know, those other kind of bread and butter issues that had been at the heart of the beginning of presidential campaigns.
Yeah, that's okay. Now I understand. Tom, that's an incredibly important question, and I'll tell you why. Recent political history suggests that we're becoming more and more, and when I say we, it's not just the United States, it's countries all over the world, are becoming more personality-driven instead of ideology-driven. And certainly President Trump in 2016 personified that. I think there's a change, though. There's a change that's happened, and it just happened in the last couple of months. We're faced with something few of us have ever seen in our lifetime, which is the double-barreled hit between an attack on our health and an attack on conscience, the latter being the George Floyd situation, the former being the COVID-19 virus. And I think that when people are scared, when they're fearful, when they're unsure, the normal response that people have is to go for what they understand and what they have and what they know, as opposed to take chances and try to change things in the middle of something that seems to be changing everything in life at a rapid pace. And that's why I think in 2020, this is going to be an election that will be based more on three ideas. One, the economy. The economy usually, go back to James Carville and everybody else, is sung from that hymnal, right? Number two is going to be the sense of personal security, which I think has come into play, frankly, in the last couple of weeks. And the third is, who's going to lead us into a future that clearly is going to be different? Those are going to be the terms of debate. Personality will count, but I think this time what the two personalities will bring to the table will count just as much.
But it's an interesting dichotomy, right? When you talk about in times of great change, it is human nature to look for what's stable and what you know. And we're at a moment in political history, at least, where the president, President Trump, has staked his political future on upsetting the status quo and upsetting the system and continuously doing that in a second term should he win re-election.
I understand the perspective, but the bottom line is, I don't think anyone out there is blaming the president of the United States for the economic peril we're now facing. They should not. I mean, it's happening. It's affecting countries all over the world, even more so, frankly, than America. But before that hit, the president of the United States is presiding over the most powerful growth in the economy in our lifetime, including incredible gains for African Americans, Hispanics, and others. So that does count for something. And how he got there.
But I suppose the criticism isn't so much the economic consequences. It's the lack of public health preparation that has led to the economic consequences here.
Tom, I understand. And by the way, I'm not arguing that point. I mean, that's a debatable point. I understand it. But before then, he was presiding over a powerful economy. Mm-hmm. And if you were, and let me just finish the point, if I could, if you were to choose up, and you're going to have to, between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, and the question is, who is the one who can best give the economy an incredible shot in the arm? I think that favors the president. And I still think at the end of the day, that's going to be a powerful motivator, despite personal feelings a lot of people may have about the person in charge.
Adam, we appreciate your time. Thanks for sharing your perspective with us here today.
Always, Tom. Thank you very much for having me.
Adam Goodman, partner at Ballard Partners and Republican media strategist. Your phone calls, we're going to return to Tampa here. Steve on line five. Steve, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. Go ahead.
All right. Well, Mr. Adam from Ballard and Partners hit the nail on the head. Let me explain two things. Number one, it was right for the president to pull out of North Carolina since the mayor over there didn't want to accommodate his request. The second point is, if we were able to support riots and have buildings burning and people pillaging businesses, and COVID-19 didn't even make a play in it, I don't see the reason why we can't have a Republican convention that allows people not to wear masks and be able to associate with one another. It doesn't seem like we really have that much fear of COVID-19 right now anyway.
I'm not the statistics show us that Thursday and Friday
statistics
of this week.
Numbers that are manipulated by scientists and by statisticians, and numbers can be changed and altered in any shape or form you want.
So, Steve, these numbers are coming from the Florida State Department of Health. You're saying that the Florida State Department of Health is manipulating these statistics?
I'm saying anybody can manipulate these numbers.
Okay, right? Fair enough. Thanks, Steve. I appreciate your input there. Let's go to David in Fort Lauderdale. David, you are on the radio now.
Thanks for taking my call. I just was wondering, given the waiver of liability that has been instituted for the president's rally in Tulsa, whether the officials of the Republican Party and the Jacksonville officials are going to have the same liability waiver for attendees of the convention or the events that are going to occur in Jacksonville.
Yeah. Yeah, this was a waiver that has been publicized for, I believe, a presidential rally that is scheduled in Oklahoma that would release any attendee from would release the organizers from any liability should an attendee contract COVID-19. Bonnie in St. Pete on line one. Bonnie, you're up. Go ahead.
Hi. I think Steve helped make my point for me. Statistics have shown that Republicans and independents tend to take the COVID much less seriously, and they don't take the 6 feet precautions. They don't tend to wear masks. And so my concern is for the hospitality workers in Jacksonville and the surrounding area who are going to have to face the choice of getting work and then exposing themselves to these people who don't take it seriously.
Bonnie, we appreciate that perspective of those hospitality workers and even the frontline healthcare workers as well. Questions about personal protection equipment certainly are swirling around and will have to be answered by those public health officials and other elected officials that are involved with organizing the convention in late August in Jacksonville. You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. So it is still early in the summer break for students, teachers, and parents, but this week, Governor Ron DeSantis announced recommendations for how to reopen schools in the fall. The governor called it a roadmap when he announced it on Thursday. While the state says schools reopening is a locally driven issue, it wants school campuses open at full capacity when the new school year begins in August. Your phone calls and tweets on this in a moment, 305-995-1800. Are you a teacher, a parent, a neighbor to a school? How do you feel about being safe in the classroom? What will make you feel comfortable by teaching in the classroom or sending your child back to school? 305-995-1800. Jessica Bakeman is an education reporter at WLRN with us in Miami. Jessica, will the state require local districts to fully reopen with all students back in the classroom come August?
No. So like you said, the plan that was released yesterday by Governor DeSantis and Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran says pretty prominently reopening is a locally driven decision. And that was the message that was received by the local superintendents here in South Florida. I checked in with the school districts that we cover to see how they were sort of interpreting it. And, you know, they basically said that their plans already were to be flexible, right? They're talking, they're doing parent and teacher surveys right now to try to figure out, do parents want to send their children to school? Do parents feel that they absolutely need to because they need to be able to get back to work? You know, what are we going to do about students who might be medically vulnerable to the virus or teachers or staff? And so it seems like the school districts, although they are planning on rolling out some more specifics over the next several weeks, are planning to be nimble. And we might have some students in this room, we might have some online, we might have some combination of that. And also they need to be ready to make a quick change at any moment if we have, you know, a spike that requires the kind of lockdown that we experienced in March.
We're talking about the reopening of public schools in Florida in August. This week, Governor Ron DeSantis released what he called a roadmap, recommendations for how local school districts to make decisions about what school will look like in August when the 2021 school year begins in really just a matter of months here. Jessica Bakeman is education reporter at WLRN in Miami. What are the public health precautions that are included in these recommendations, Jess?
Well, the recommendations are 143 pages, so it's a lot to get through. A okay. lot of it has to do with how to sanitize and cleanse schools, how to, you know, keep desks farther. For example, gives you a sense of how the language is very flexible. A lot of the statements or recommendations start with something like as feasible, right? So as feasible and while maintaining the goal of getting students on campus every day, explore staggered schedules, start and end times to limit crowds. As feasible, convert cafeterias, libraries, gyms, auditoriums, outdoor areas into classroom space. So those are some of the things they're talking about is how can they sort of redesign what the school day looks like so that students are not that clear. Yeah. They might be in the classroom to eat lunch. They might be being with the same group of students all day long instead of switching with a lot of different classes, which will limit the number of people who are interacting with each other on a daily basis.
Jess, hold the line here with us. We're talking about the reopening of public schools, what that may look like in August. 305-995-1800. You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Frederick Ingram joins us now. He is the president of the Florida Education Association. Frederick, welcome back to the Roundup. Nice to have you on again. Do you support the governor's recommendations for reopening public schools in August?
So we support the initiative to try and reopen schools as feasible. But we are certainly looking for our superintendents and our teachers, and our principals to make all the right decisions for our students and those who take care of those students during those school hours.
So what are the public precautions that the FEA, the teachers union, is prioritizing in putting together the protocols and the plans?
Guided by the science, we're being guided by the CDC regulations in terms of social distancing, mandatory hand washing, separations as much as we can in common areas like cafeterias and other areas, gymnasiums and that kind of thing. And so we are watching all, as you heard, the governor's plan is about 143 pages. So we're scouring through that to make sure that it is fully comprehensive.
Will the FEA support things like mandatory facial coverings, masks for teachers?
we will support whatever the science tells us to do in the CDC. And so we know that we have vulnerable students who come with underlying issues. We know that we have vulnerable teachers and educational support professionals who may be age sensitive in terms of where they are as it relates to catching this virus, or they may have some underlying issues. And so if the science guides us there, we certainly are watching that and monitoring that, and we certainly will adhere to those types of things to ensure that safety is job one.
Give us a sense of that, right? Because the Centers for Disease Control makes these kinds of recommendations. We've heard it from other public health officials about the use of masks, but they're not, you know, they're also not 100% guaranteed protection. It's you know, staying at home, those kinds of precautions that even bring a higher sense of security. Clearly, that may or may not be the case when August rolls around. It's time for another school year. So, Frederick, when you're talking about being guided by the science, is that pointing back to the CDC guidelines that that the FEA, the teachers union, will essentially follow?
Yes. And so what I will say is this, nothing is 100% as it relates to this virus, right? There is something that we must use as a benchmark, as a framework. And so that is the most practical and the most feasible and makes the most educational sense for us to be guided by that. And so we are looking into certainly other things in terms of hybrid scheduling, in terms of scheduling, you know, having lunch in classrooms. I mean, I could go on for another 2 days about some of the things that
we're doing. What about like daily temperature checks at the front door?
Absolutely. And that is a part of the discussions that we'll have. But what we do agree with the governor and the commissioner is that those decisions will be made at the local level. And we need to have parents involved, school boards involved, superintendents involved, and stakeholders, really, because this is going to impact an entire community.
Frederick, stick with us here. We got a break coming up here, but we got a lot more to talk about. Frederick Ingram is with us, the Florida Education Association president. Jessica Bakeman is the WLRN education reporter in South Florida. Your phone calls as we talk about the potential, the reopening of schools. What is that going to look like in August? What are your concerns about going back to the classroom? Classroom or sending a child back to the classroom. 305-995-1800. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks again for listening to Florida Public Radio and supporting public media here in the Sunshine State. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. My co-host Melissa Ross is off this week. Plans to return to school in August are taking shape right now. The state would like schools to fully reopen for the traditional start of the school year. Parents, teachers, students, we want to hear from you. How will you go back to the classroom while staying protected against COVID-19? 305-995-1800 across the state. 305-995-1800. Or you can find us on Twitter at Florida Roundup. WLRN education reporter in Miami, Jessica Bakeman, is back with us. Frederick Ingram is also with us. He is the president of the Florida Education Association. Folks, we've got Hope, who is a middle school student in Tampa. Hope, thanks for calling in. Go ahead. You're on the radio.
Hi. I'm a middle schooler in Tampa. And for one of my orchestra classes, I have 50 kids in a small room, and I don't think we can social distance. And I know social distancing is very important, so how are we going to reopen when we cannot social distance in classrooms?
Hope, that's a great question. Hold on with us. Frederick, what do you say to Hope, orchestra student who has to be in the room with the full orchestra? You want all the musicians in there so that everybody stays in harmony, on melody, and on beat.
Right. Thank you, Hope, for that question. And as a former band director, I certainly appreciate that. And so we have long talked about smaller class sizes, perhaps having two orchestra teachers in two different classrooms so that we can bring down the amount of students in a particular class, maybe having your orchestra class in a bigger room or even perhaps in a gymnasium where we can social distance. We believe that there are things that are practical that we can actually do to take care of that, but we're going to try really hard to make sure that all classes are safe. And thank you for the question. I certainly appreciate it.
Hope, what instrument do you play, Hope?
I play the violin.
Awesome. Well, keep up the practicing over the summer months. Hope, a middle school student, violinist in Tampa, joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Jessica Bakeman, our education reporter at WLRN in Miami, part of the state's roadmap and recommendations that it announced for some of the guidelines it would like to see as a return to school in August, talked about federal funding that came from the CARES Act. This is one of the stimulus programs that was approved in light of the COVID-19 measures taken. What money is in there? Where would it go in Florida for education purposes?
Right. And I'll start by saying that the school superintendents, not only in South Florida, but throughout the country, have asked the federal government for a lot more money than what was in this bill. And I think something that Frederick just said really speaks to it, because if you want to have smaller class sizes, you need to have more staff. Yeah. And obviously, you have to pay them. But as far as the CARES Act funding, The Commissioner of Education laid out a breakdown of where that money would go. And it includes money for childcare for first responders and healthcare workers, which obviously is really important. You know, if students are not able to go to school, that those people are able to get to work so they can help us respond to the pandemic. There's also money for summer recovery programs, which we're definitely going to see all across the country to try to combat the academic regression that students have experienced. There's also money for 2,000 reading coaches and also regional reading consultants that the state is calling literary SEAL Team 6. So they're trying to get the response to make sure that students don't fall behind. Also free SAT and ACTs for students. And something that I know will be controversial, money in there to help stabilize private schools, which are really struggling in the pandemic, and also to sort of fill in holes that might be left in funding for the tax credit scholarship programs, which some argue would be important to make sure there's not a huge amount of students that are leaving the private schools where they currently attend and then flooding back into the public schools, just as the public schools are trying to figure out how we can keep, you know, limit crowds.
Yeah. Terry is a teacher in Jacksonville who joins us now. Terry, thanks for calling in. You're on the radio.
Yes. On NPR, on Here and Now, you covered a story where in 1940, the measles were battled with UVC lighting. It's just basically an upside-down umbrella where you block the light from touching any of the students, but you use a ceiling fan to drive all the air in the room up over the lights, and then the UVC, I'm a chemistry teacher, so UVC light does kill it. They use it to kill MRSA. Why can't the schools just save all the other money on extra staff and equip the schools with this? If we're going to be dealing with this over and over again, isn't this a more viable long-term solution that's really not all that expensive? I actually own a UVC light, and it's just a tube. It looks like a normal.
Yeah, you know, what do you know about UVC light and the coronavirus, Terry? What have you been reading about?
That it kills 99.9% of everything there. And so it's actually unprecedented in terms of its ability to kill everything. So it's very, if you look it up, and you can all Google it, it works.
Terry, what do you teach in Jacksonville?
Chemistry.
You do teach chemistry. Okay,
yeah,
fair
I do
enough.
Actually do teach chemistry. And right now, hospitals in Boston have those UVC lights up in their ceilings for the waiting rooms. So when people come in, it kills everything in the room there. So
Terry,
it's actually being used today.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Frederick, are these kinds of solutions part of any conversations that the Education Association is having with the state about utilizing these kinds of ideas?
So I want to thank Terry for her service as an educator. Nothing that I have seen or read tells me that the UVC lights work. I will go back and read again. But, you know, our hospitals, you know, with our healthcare workers have been catching this virus. And it seems to me that there would have been something that has been in print that says that this is an effective way to do that. So I won't hypothesize about whether it works or not. I will go back and do some research, but I have not seen that.
Let me remind folks that you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Jessica Bakeman, you want to tackle the chemistry teacher's idea?
Yes, well, sort of. Like Frederick, I don't know much about the lights, but I did want to just mention that superintendents are talking about different ways we can outfit schools to make them safer. And Superintendent Alberto Carvalho in Miami-Dade was talking yesterday about how, you know, we might need funding not only, of course, for masks and gloves and all of the supplies that you need to regularly sanitize schools, but also we might need things like shields, like what we've seen go up in grocery stores or banks to, you know, put some space or put that literal shield between, you know, maybe a teacher and a student or however he sort of envisions that working. But kind of the main point that's coming from the superintendents about all this stuff is it is going to be very expensive to do, and we need the money to do it.
Heather in Tampa. Heather, you've got a trio of kids at home this summer. So what are you thinking about August?
I do. One of my concerns is tracing. I know in Tampa at a few schools we've had in the past lice outbreaks, and parents aren't usually told when it happens till, you know, you don't know till it's your kid. And if they won't tell us about that, are they going to tell us when the child has COVID? And are they going to trace the trail? I'm also concerned about the finances. Hillsborough County is cash strapped. I mean, we've had kids going to school without AC. I've been involved in advocacy for two of my kids' schools. And so I'm really concerned about the finances. I wish the governor would do something to finance all of this.
Yeah, Heather, big questions there. I'm going to tackle the financing question and kind of frame it in a much smaller area that I think all parents probably have experience with, which is buying additional supplies for classrooms, even during the best of financial times, Frederick. As a parent, I can tell you I've supplied paper towels and soap and wipes and, coloring instruments and other kinds of things for my kids' classroom. I'm lucky enough to be in a position to be able to do that. Now, with the cash strap position because of lower state revenues due to the economic consequences, and now the additional cost of protective measures, what's the FEA to say to the state about that? What are you advocating for?
Sure. Well, this is a great point. In January, before the pandemic actually hit our state, we brought 15,000 people to Tallahassee to talk about funding for education. It was a campaign called Fund Our Future. And we've worked really hard to make sure that we give voice to the lack of funding that we've had for the past 20 years. We fund our public schools at 2008 and 2009 school levels, which is abysmal. And so we need money for programming. We need money for health and safety. We need money for those educators who are going to be doing this work. In January, we had 2,000 classrooms that did not have a certified teacher. I would only assume that that's going to be exacerbated at the beginning of school. And so we need to fully fund. The governor needs to sign the legislative budget so that these school districts can get to work. And we need to make sure and monitor those dollars that are coming from the CARES Act so that we fully fund our schools.
Could you envision, Jessica, different rules in different counties in August?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and I think that especially affects South Florida because South Florida has been the epicenter. And as we've seen, you know, South Florida is sort of just starting to reopen, whereas the rest of the state is way ahead of us on that. And I think that we might see the same thing reflected throughout the state in terms of what school districts decide to do.
And Frederick, your guidance in our last just 15 seconds here for preparation toward the August start date?
Be very careful and put our students' health and safety first. Make sure that we understand that there are grandparents, there are aunts and uncles and community members who will be affected if our students are affected, if they're carriers or if they're infected by this virus.
And Frederick, so we have to leave it there. Frederick Ingram, the president of the Florida Education Association, Jessica Bakeman, education reporter with us at WLRN. Thanks to both of you for your time today.
Thanks, Tom.
We did invite the Education Commissioner, Richard Corcoran, to participate in our discussion. He did not respond to our request. That is our program here today. It is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are the producers. Jason Zapka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming. The Director of Radio Operations in Miami is Peter Mayers. He's also our Technical Director. We get engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. For Melissa Ross, I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting Public Radio.